Welcome to class 4 of Copernicus and the Jews. I want to begin just with a couple of groups of quotations. You may recognize some of them. Nachamu nachamu ami yomar Elohechem. Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak to the heart of Jerusalem and cry out to her, for her warfare is full, for her sin is paid for she has received from Yad Adonai, the hand of the Lord, a double portion in all her sins. Unto a great mountain go up for yourself, Mevaseret Zion, proclaimer of good news, Zion. Lift up your voice in strength, Mevaseret Yerushalayim, proclaimer of good news, Jerusalem. Lift it up, do not fear, say to the cities of Yehuda, Hine Elohechem, behold your God. And now the second set, extra ecclesiam nulla salus, which in Latin means outside the church there is no salvation, and is part of the Catholic Creed and also repeated in other Christian traditions. Outside of the Christian church there is no truth, no Christ, no salvation. That's Martin Luther from the Protestant tradition. Now, one of these sets of quotes contains some very good news for the Jewish people. And God's message, as expressed in the scriptures, is supposed to be good news for Israel. It's supposed to bring comfort, as Isaiah 40, the first quote, expresses. One of these groups of quotes does that, the other does not. The two quotes are from two different worlds, two different conceptual universes, and therefore a person must decide which world they want to belong to. Before we get to that, though, let's just follow up a little bit on last class. Does anyone remember what we talked about last time?
Chapter 3.
It was a while ago, I know.
Doesn't make any difference.
What was the title last time?
No.
Right. Could anyone summarize a little bit of what we discussed?
There's no Old Testament, there's no New Testament.
Okay. Why not? And what is there?
I wasn't here, so I'm going to...
Oh, okay. Let's ask... Okay, let's ask someone who is here too, though, to maybe more specifically describe what we discussed.
Misuse of the word testament as opposed to covenant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, anyone want to expand on that? I already talked for 2 hours about this last time, so I don't need to talk more about it.
about how in chapter... I think it's 8. The two verses, I forgot which ones, don't make sense.
In Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 8?
Yeah, Hebrews chapter 8. Don't make sense the way they're written in the English as far as covenant and testament and will and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar, that the verse refers to a mediator of, and in, it's commonly written mediator of a testament, but it's explained how a testament is not for those who are living, and it's by someone who is now deceased. It's a last will and disposal of property, whereas this is a covenant. These are two groups who are still existing, and so... You can't have a mediator between a solitary person's dispersal of goods.
Okay. This was one example that we discussed, and it relates to the chapter before that of Jewish Greek.
I think the thing I got out of last week's class, or last time we met the class, was the Old Covenant is superseded by the New Covenant, but the Scriptures are not superseded. The Scriptures are still in force. The only difference is what Yeshua fulfilled has been replaced with the new covenant, but the other things, all the other scriptures of the old covenant are still valid.
Okay. I'll just briefly restate some of the things that we covered last time, and you can also now listen to the audio online if you'd like to review as well. But basically, the point of the chapter was that the terms Old Testament and New Testament are non-biblical ones. So they're outside of what God is saying. That's number one. They're also inaccurate terms and misleading terms. And we can explain how they arose historically, looking at the process of translation from Hebrew into Jewish Greek, the interpretation of that Greek as being a kind of Christian Greek, and the translation into Latin, and the consequent errors that accumulated. And the claim was also made in the chapter that this is a very important distinction. In other words, it makes a difference if you think of the Bible as divided into an Old Testament and a New Testament, or even if you think of the Bible as divided into an Old Covenant and a New Covenant, which it isn't. Where does the New Covenant occur? Where is the New Covenant found?
Jeremiah 31.
The New Covenant is part of what Christians call the Old Testament. It's found in Jeremiah 31. And it's simply quoted later in Hebrews. So that was part of what we looked at. And then we did look at this specific example in Hebrews, which quotes from Jeremiah 31, and which in almost all modern translations is incomprehensible. Maybe I'll give you a couple examples just to remind you. For example, in the New American Standard Translation, Hebrews, this is actually Hebrews 9, verse 17, a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. What are the problems with this statement?
Noah and God never died.
It's completely false. It's completely false in its representation of a covenant, and it's completely false in its representation of the new covenant. So we discussed how these actually false statements made their way into Christian translations of what is considered to be the New Testament. And we also discussed some how to find the correct understanding. So, again, if you want to review that in more detail, you can actually listen to the audio.
One of the things that was interesting to me was description of the Brit, whereas I had no background or understanding of that, it involved a little cutting as it's used. And I found, prior to understanding that, his example completely confusing. It's like it didn't make any sense to me either.
Oh, whose example, sorry?
Your father's.
Okay. But after that, you were able to understand it?
But it wasn't explained in the book.
Okay. All right. Well, let me actually read from a Bible dictionary. I looked at this as a result of our conversation last time. This is Smith's Bible Dictionary, a standard Christian reference work. And under covenant, it says the Hebrew brit means primarily a cutting, with reference to the custom of cutting or dividing animals in two and passing between the parts in ratifying a covenant. And it gives some examples from Genesis and Jeremiah. In the New Testament, the corresponding word is diatheke, which is frequently, though by no means uniformly, translated testament in the Authorized Version. So that's part of what we were discussing last time, the mistranslation of diatheke as testament, even though it was obvious that it really meant covenant. And you can see that even within the Christian tradition, it was recognized that diatheke referred to a covenant. So we can charitably say, perhaps, that these translations, which include testament, were done in ignorance, and they may have been to some extent, but it's possible also to wonder whether it really was ignorance or something else. And this week, when we look at Ecclesia and Synagoge, we'll be getting into translations that are distorted definitely not through ignorance, but certainly through a very conscious decision. Diatheke may have been sometimes through ignorance. But that actually goes back to the point that I think you raised last time with regard to English words, covenant, contract, and so forth. And I was thinking about this a little more after class. And in fact, if we really reflect on our language, then when we're speaking in a biblical way, we are actually using a type of Judeo-English. Because if when we say covenant, we really mean everything that's encompassed by brit, that is a kind of Judeo-English. That is a kind of taking of an English word and imbuing it with a Hebraic significance. The same thing if we say contract or pacto or something like that, and what we really mean is what the Hebrew term signifies. So if we have the correct biblical meaning, we are almost using a form of Judeo-English. There were a couple other things I wanted to quickly follow up on from last time before we get into today's material. One was a question that Marcus asked about Hebrews in the quotation of Jeremiah 31, in which he noticed that there was an additional phrase added in saying that God had turned away from Israel when they broke his covenant. And we speculated last time that this was a result of quoting from the Septuagint. The Septuagint does not always correspond exactly to the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text that we have today. And that is, in fact, the case. The Septuagint, which was, of course, made centuries before Christianity, states, Kai ego himelisa auton, so, and I turned away from them, a phrase that is not in the Masoretic text, not in the Hebrew. So likely this was an interpolation made by those Jewish translators, or it could possibly have been something that was in their version of the Hebrew text that we had at that time. There's no way of knowing for sure, because our texts date from later, but it's more likely, given what we know about the Septuagint, that it was interpolated. And so this translation is actually followed in Jeremiah. This is, of course, the Septuagint's translation of Jeremiah, where it has that additional phrase. So that phrase is followed by other translations which base themselves on the Septuagint. For example, I looked at the Slavonic Bible, and it includes that phrase.
Yep. It seems like in some cases we feel able to trust the Septuagint, and in other cases we just, oh, that's something to dismiss, and I'm not really sure how you're drawing the line and where the Jewish interpreters or translators did derive that phrase and why they put it in there.
Well, again, there's no way to be 100% certain about that. But for the purposes of this class, I can tell you basically where we're drawing the line. We're using the Septuagint for linguistic understanding, to show how the language of Jewish Greek arose and what content it contains as a result of being the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures. We're not necessarily getting into the question of how reliable the content is when it is different from the content of the Masoretic text. That's a much bigger and different question that is, debated endlessly in many different types of settings. But for the purposes of this class, we're doing something that doesn't depend on that. We're just looking at the language.
I don't want to add more controversy.
Yes, you do.
But I will.
No, I don't. I purposely preface what I'm about to say by that statement. I'm simply asking for a clarification. I am hearing a presupposition in what you're saying, and the presupposition is that the Masoretic texts, as opposed to the majority texts, are authoritative. Is that a presupposition that you're operating under?
No, I'm not operating under that presupposition. So that's why I said there's no way we can know for certain.
Okay.
You know, whether it was in the Hebrew text that they had at the time.
You keep saying, as it was not in the Masoretic text.
Right.
As opposed, there's different schools, as you know. Many rely on what's called the majority texts, taking the position that God would not limit the number of copies that are available, to such a few number as is in the Masoretic case. And therefore, they adopt what's called the majority text. And then there's those who say, but the Masoretic are clearly the oldest, and therefore, ergo sum, the most original. And I don't know which side to fall upon, but I'd like to know if you're establishing a presupposition.
No, I don't want to establish that presupposition.
Okay, that's all
but
I need to know.
That's exactly, yeah, okay. But that's exactly the kind of thing that I was saying.
I don't want to create a controversy. I'm just asking.
No, I understand. It's a good point, and that's exactly the kind of thing that I was saying can be endlessly discussed as part of a different course, if you will. We're not going to get into that too much. I guess in my comments, I'm privileging the Masoretic text because it is the text that is considered standard and most reliable, and it is, of course, the text that is in the original language. It's also the text from which our translations today are usually based. So, again, I'm not establishing the presupposition that the Masoretic text is always correct when the Septuagint is different. But I am privileging the Masoretic text a little bit, at least for the purposes of our discussion. And in using the Septuagint, I think it's not debatable at all, and we're not on shaky ground at all when we look at the Septuagint for linguistic purposes. Because then we can very clearly see what's going on, and it has a very direct impact on how we understand later Jewish Greek texts.
Can you just count Masoretic is spelled, just to look it up later?
Masoretic.
Thanks.
It means tradition.
No.
Masorah is tradition, the traditional text. Yeah.
Okay. And it was compiled by Jewish scholars, or scribes, in the first millennium, and they were called Masoretes. The second point I wanted to follow up on from last time was simply with regard to the name Miriam. I mentioned that in the Jewish Greek text, her name is actually given as Mariam, and nonetheless, translators will still give this as Mary in English or in other languages. Now, in looking at this, it is usually Mariam. Sometimes it's also Maria. So just so that you know, both forms appear in the Jewish Greek text. I think this makes it even more obvious what's going on, which is that you have a Hebrew name and the Greek version of it, just as you do for virtually all of the other people who appear in these texts. Nonetheless, the translators make a choice to translate it differently from the Mariam, Maria, of what they consider to be the Old Testament, in other words, the sister of Moses and Aaron. Okay, any other questions or issues just based on what we've said so far, which really relates to last class and not the chapter for today? Well, then today we have a chapter entitled A Good Church is Hard to Find, subtitled There is No Church in the Bible. I'm going to make a bold statement that is derived from the material in this chapter, and it's simply this. As long as you think about a church, as long as you think in terms of the church or a church, you cannot understand the Bible. That's a notion that is completely absent from the Bible, and it also contradicts many of the ideas of the Bible, at least in the way that it's been interpreted throughout history. Again, I'd like to point out that when we talk about how church arose and the various translations of ecclesia in particular, we'll discover that we're not talking about something that arose by chance or something that arose innocently through ignorance. We're actually talking about a conscious decision that was made dishonestly to mistranslate these words, to translate them in one way in certain contexts, and to translate them in a completely different way in other contexts. Now, of course, you can evaluate that for yourself as we go through, and I hope you already have evaluated it as you read the chapter, and I hope you have questions and comments. But basically what I'd like to do is go through the chapter fairly sequentially in terms of the way that it's presented. And the first section dealt with this encounter with a Polish Jesuit priest. A Polish Jesuit priest who was unusual in that he responded in the affirmative to a rather unique question. The question was, if I tell you that ekklesia is simply the Jewish Greek word used for kahal, do you understand what I mean? Yes, he answered. What did this Polish Jesuit priest understand?
Perhaps the concept of kahal?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Hebrew concept of it?
Mm-hmm. The Hebrew concept of kahal, which we could briefly describe as
assembly, gathering
a congregation, used most frequently for the congregation of Israel, not exclusively, but most frequently for the congregation of Israel. Okay, so what he understood is that ekklesia is simply the Jewish Greek word for that. What implications does that statement have?
Obviously, it's not translated as church.
Right. Yes, kahal is obviously not translated as church. Kahal refers to the congregation of Israel. So if ecclesia is simply the equivalent of that, what that means is that ecclesia has been mistranslated all throughout history, and that there's a systematic error in Christian understanding of the scriptures. So that's a rather unique Jesuit priest who would be able to acknowledge and understand that. What actually is intended by Kahal and Ecclesia in Tanakh, in the passages in which we encounter them in Tanakh?
Well, it's more of a public thing, you know, a community thing rather than a religious thing. It can be religious, but it's community.
Okay. So you could actually view it outside of any religious overtones that we would give to it, and just view it as some sort of community. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oftentimes, as is common hermeneutically from the scriptures, the context and the text determines its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Always it means an assembly of like-minded or like people, mm-hmm. but as to whether it is, you know, designed specifically to have spiritual significance or not is determined entirely by the context, entirely by the text. Who's speaking, what they're speaking of, who they're speaking to.
Okay, maybe we can just look at some examples to illustrate this.
Sure.
On page 54, you have a list of passages in which the word kahal, the Hebrew word kahal, appears. So why don't we just take three or four examples? When you find your favorite example, you can read it out.
But if a person who is unclean does not purify himself, he must be cut off from the kahal, because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water of cleansing has not been sprinkled on him, and he is unclean. Tomei.
I proclaim your righteousness in the great kahal. Behold, you know, O Lord, my lips did not conceal it. Psalm 40, mm-hmm. verse 10.
Isaac said to Jacob, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful, and make you numerous until you become a kahal of peoples.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Well, those ones all seem to have a nice positive significance, but let me read the first one, which everyone skipped over as well, just so we get a well-rounded picture of what kahal means. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not join their kahal. Okay.
Sounds pretty anti-Semitic.
Well, I think you're jumping to conclusions there. I don't think it's anti-Semitic. I think it's saying that Simeon and Levi, because of their actions, are people that you would not want to join in a congregation or an assembly with. So the word obviously does not just mean a community of nice people or a community of people even that God looks favorably on. But it is a community, and it's most often used for the community of the Lord, the community of Israel. Let's look at a related word, Edah. I believe you also have some examples of Edah. Those might actually be just before.
That root of the word Edah is witness. So it means sort of the same thing, but as kahal is more of a public social thing, kahal is more of a together witnessing thing. Like, you're witnesses to what somebody's saying or what they're speaking, whether it's political or religious.
All right. Does that mean that when Edah is used, that it's always used in a positive sense of people that are witnesses for the Lord?
No.
No. Can you give me an example?
Didn't Korah have an Edah with him that fell into the earth?
Exactly.
And got swallowed up?
Exactly. Edah is used to designate the group of 250 men who followed Korah in rebellion. Numbers 26:10, 27:3. So Edah also is not used exclusively in a positive sense. These are both words that simply describe a gathering of people, whether for good or bad, or a neutral purpose. Now, in translating these Hebrew words into Greek or Jewish Greek, the authors of the Septuagint obviously had to choose Greek words. in order to render them, or else they had to transliterate, of course. They, in this case, they chose Greek words. What Greek words did they choose in order to render Kahal and Eda?
Synagogue. Synagogue.
For Kahal, usually ekklesia. For Eda, usually synagoge. What did these words mean in Greek?
Gatherings.
Very similar meaning, a gathering. Ekklesia could refer to a council of a city. It could refer to another form of a gathering. Synagoge just meant a group of people drawn together. That's what it means. Led together, synagoge. That's the literal etymological meaning of the word. So these words were actually fairly suitable for rendering Kahal and Eda in the text of the Septuagint in order to express what God was saying. So God has his Kahal, but there are other Kahals also. God has his Eda, but there are other Edas as well. And this carries over to the meaning of ekklesia and synagoge in the Septuagint. Both can be used in a positive or negative sense. They can refer to God's people or to another congregation of people. And so one thing that we have to recognize right away is that whatever ekklesia and synagoge are supposed to mean in the texts of the scriptures, in the Septuagint, and consequently in the Messianic writings, it's certainly not something new. But their meaning is very well entrenched and has been established all throughout Tanakh in God's description of the Kahal and the Edah, of whatever kind they may happen to be in each particular passage, in each particular context. So, for example, one thing that we can say already is that we're not going to find the birthday of the church in the Bible, because there's obviously nothing new intended by these words. They have a very well entrenched meaning, stretching back for centuries, if not millennia. Of course, originally from the Hebrew, but via the Jewish Greek. One example that was given to sort of drive home the point about correspondence between the Hebrew and Greek had to do with Kohelet. Who was Kohelet?
The writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher.
Okay, Kohelet is sometimes translated as the preacher or the collector. It's the title of a book in the Bible in Hebrew, Kohelet. It might have different meanings. It might mean someone who collects sayings, or it might mean someone who speaks to the assembly, the collection of people. That's the way it was interpreted. And so in Greek, Kohelet became Ecclesiastes. Well, it's called Ecclesiastes in English. I guess it might be Ecclesiasticus or something like that in the original Greek. But so in other words, the root of Kahal was translated in this case as well by the root of ekklesia when going from Hebrew into Jewish Greek. So that's just one more example of the correspondence. Now, there was a quotation on the bottom of page 56 and the top of page 57 which drew this comparison more directly. And it says basically, thus the use of ekklesia for Kahal and synagoge for Eda in the Septuagint Psalms are not a reflection of distinctions in meaning between either the Hebrew or the Greek words, but the result of a conscious stereotyping policy. The outcome was so-called lexical Hebraisms that, quote, do not function as ordinary Greek words possessing Greek meanings, but rather as mere symbols representing Hebrew words, end quote. So again, this quotation very clearly expresses the idea of Jewish Greek, but just for these particular examples. In other words, here are two more pairs. We talked about these different pairs. We discussed Mashiach and Christos and so forth. Here are two more pairs. Ekklesia Kahal, or rather Kahal Ekklesia Eda Synagoge. What's happening in the Jewish Greek text is obviously the attempt to find in the Greek language some way of expressing the Hebrew concept. And so the Greek word is always a pointer back to the Hebrew concept. One cannot look at the Greek word as the source of the meaning. Any questions or comments at this point? No, all right. I don't know if that means that you're all in agreement or something else. Yes?
I'm new, so I didn't do the third chapter.
Fourth
chapter is what I said. So, oh. two thoughts are coming to mind. One, lately I've been referring to the quote-unquote New Testament as more properly thought of maybe as the completion chapters. And I've heard others do this that I didn't hear say it before I had, but maybe that's taking hold somehow. And because I've always said it's 44 writers, 66 chapters in a continuous flow. And the other thought is, you made a comment a little while ago about the beginning of quote-unquote the church, the worldwide body of believers, if you'll accept that phrasing. But don't we have some kind of an understanding that that was taking on a whole new emphasis or meaning at Pentecost?
Okay, I think both questions are very similar and related. And I'm going to answer first by saying that, in a sense, that's not the topic of this course.
Okay.
Because what we're doing actually is attempting to dismantle certain systematic errors that have resulted in some conclusions and interpretations about the Bible.
Okay.
Now, I would argue that some of what you said is part of that system and part of those interpretations that result from that. But we're not at the stage, really, at this point in the book at least, of establishing the correct alternate system, if you will, or the correct alternate interpretation. We're merely pointing out that this entire system is flawed in some very serious ways. So one consequence of that may be that we have to abandon some of the concepts that you described. Or maybe those concepts will turn out to be perfectly fine when we get rid of the errors. But we'll have to wait and see. You can guess which way I lean. But I think in terms of our sequential study, that's the way we're going about it. And I guess in terms of Pentecost, we talked a little bit about Pentecost last time. Of course, Pentecost is not a new meaning either. Pentecost is simply the Jewish-Greek way of saying Shavuot.
Mm-hmm.
So if we imbue a different meaning to the word Pentecost as we do to the word Shavuot, we have a problem. And the same thing if we're thinking that there's something completely new going on with the Ekklesia, because Ekklesia is just talking about the Kahal that God has given us hundreds, or maybe, I'm assuming, hundreds of verses about already. So we have to understand first what God has said about the Kahal before we can see what he says later about the Kahal, in which in our version is rendered as Ekklesia. But a point that we should keep in mind is that the conversations that we have recorded in the Messianic writings, what Christians call the New Testament, and perhaps some of the writings themselves, almost certainly did not take place in Greek. These are translations of conversations that we have. When Yeshua was speaking with his disciples, why would he have spoken in Greek? Almost certainly he did not. He spoke in Hebrew or Aramaic. So we're reading translations of conversations, which again should drive home the point for us that the actual concepts that are being discussed are the Hebraic ones. Thanks for that comment. Anyone else? Okay. Let's look then at Ekklesia and Synagogue as they are used in the Messianic writings. And you had several examples. I think this begins on page 60. Ekklesia in the Messianic writings, Ekklesia in the translations, and so forth. So were there any examples from this section that you can draw out and use as an illustration of the point of the chapter?
Where Yeshua says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I will tell you that you are Kepha, and on this rock I will build my ecclesia, and the gates of Sheol will not overcome it."
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the question that follows that quotation is, how should ecclesia be translated here? And the point, let me just read that paragraph because it's a repetition of what we just said. Keep in mind, again, that Yeshua was not speaking in Greek, and Matthew, as far as we know, was not writing in Greek. Yeshua did not say ekklesia, and Matthew did not write ekklesia. Ekklesia in our Greek text is already translated from the original Hebrew word. So how should it therefore be translated with this in mind?
Either kahal or eidah.
Right. We should use some term that resembles kahal, most likely, because that's the one that corresponds to ecclesia usually. And if we wanted to find an English equivalent,
Roman Catholic Church.
Roman Catholic Gathering, that's right. A congregation of some kind. Yeshua is talking about his kahal. Yeshua has a kahal, just as there are different types of kahals that are described. And I think it's not a stretch to say in the context of the Bible that the kahal that belongs to Yeshua is the same kahal that belongs to God, that he has described over and over in Tanakh.
In modern Hebrew, you have a term called kahal rav, which is what Yeshua always had around him, was a kahal rav, a big crowd. You know, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. A big assembly, yeah, big crowd.
Let me pose as the opposing attorney for a moment.
Uh-oh. All right.
Let's take the context. And the purpose of my doing this is not necessarily to be argumentative, but simply to present an argument that will come forth. Oh, well, yes, you're right. Yeshua is speaking of his gathering, his community. But obviously he is speaking to Peter at this moment and is making a statement of fact. Why is he making that statement of fact? Is there something unique about this particular kahal that Yeshua would find it necessary to announce to the world through the Messianic writings that he was establishing this kahal and then he established it by speaking directly to Peter? Okay, what is the purpose of this? Is there something unique about this? Is he not establishing something new, something that has not existed before? Otherwise, why would he even bother? I mean, it is obvious that it's his kahal. It's been his kahal all along. There were 13 guys that ran along with him, you know, at various times, 11, 12, or 13, and that was his kahal, and now it's a larger kahal, because there were 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, okay, that professed faith in him at Shavuot. So, why? What's the purpose of his making this statement at all, unless it's to establish some new creation?
Well, that's a good question, but I think there's a presupposition in what you're saying, which is that when Yeshua says something, he's establishing something new. And we could argue about that, but I think most of the time when Yeshua speaks, as when all of the Hebrew prophets speak, they say something that is original, but it's not new in the sense of being completely innovative. It's the same message that God has spoken ever since Bereshit, the beginning of time. Okay, wait, let me answer. Okay. The second part of my answer is, well, why are you asking me that? What you're saying may or may not be true, but first of all, let's try to establish what the text actually says. Then we can argue over what it means. In other words, what we're discussing right now is a linguistic issue, not a theological issue. And people get very nervous because they immediately do understand the theological implications, whether they make those conscious or not. But we're not discussing any theological issues right now. We're only discussing linguistic issues. And linguistically, it's very clear that it's simply a reference to kahal. Right. Now, let me give you another example to drive that point home. You gave, or someone, whoever it was that gave this example, gave the prototypical example of ecclesia as church as it's interpreted in Christian theology. Well, let me give you another example, and let's see how popular this one is in Christian theology. It's on page 64, talking about Acts 19. On one occasion when Paul was in Ephesus, the idol makers started a riot to try to stop him from proclaiming Yeshua, a proclamation which they considered a threat to their commercial interests. And in fact, in the text, it's even a little broader than that. It says when they saw he was a Jew, they started this uproar. Right. So they didn't even know necessarily the particularity of what he was proclaiming. But they knew he was a Jew, and to be a Jew meant to proclaim one God. And these were idol makers. He was threatening their livelihood. The tumultuous mob rushed into the theater where they shouted for hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians, a false god." The Greek word used to describe this riotous mob in the city theater is ekklesia. The ekklesia was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there, Acts 19:32. Whether or not that accurately describes some church to which you have been, Luke simply used ecclesia to refer to an assembly of people. As the town clerk said in quieting the mob, if there's anything further you want to bring up, it must be settled in a legal ecclesia. As it is, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion since there is no reason for it. After he said this, he dismissed the ecclesia. So how many of you have English translations in which ecclesia in this passage is translated as church?
Zero of us.
Why not?
Good question.
I rest my case. And you see how easy the case is, in fact. Now, these are controversial issues not because of the language, but because of the theology. So let's look at the language and just try to see what the text actually says. I mean, again, a point I made in one of the previous classes, most of us are here because we actually want to know what God says. We're interested in it. We'd like to draw closer to him. We may even be interested in his relationship with his people. Well, he's given us his word, but if we distort it and change it into something else, are we really getting his ideas? Some of it obviously will filter through, but we're not getting the original message, that's for sure. And here's one clear instance in which the translation has distorted what millions of people have and still do understand to be the message of Yeshua and the message of the Bible, because they think that ecclesia means church because it's translated in that way in certain passages, and they think the church is something new that Jesus brought about, and they don't realize that ecclesia is also used to describe the riotous mob in Ephesus that wanted to kill Paul. But it is. Those are just the linguistic facts, and you can still today look at a Greek text and see them very clearly. So let's deal with what is, not with our theoretical reconstruction of what probably exists based on accumulated theology. Any other examples? We could probably go then to the Tyndale's translation, which starts on page 65. Can someone tell us the story of Tyndale as it's described in this chapter with regard to the issue of ecclesia?
Doesn't use church.
Other than the fact that it cost him his life?
Well, it cost him his life.
He used the word.
Why did it cost him his life?
Used God's smuggler in the 1600s or 1500s.
Okay. Yeah. It cost him his life partly because he wanted to give an accurate rendition of God's word, not an acceptable rendition of God's word. And as part of his attempt to give an accurate rendition of God's word, he translated ecclesia as, I believe, congregation or community. For Tyndale's efforts, the church had him burned at the stake. It is not without significance that throughout history, the greatest, most enduring opposition to the scriptures has come from the church. As Tyndale faced death, he said, quote, I call God to record that I have never altered against the voice of my conscience one syllable of his word, nor would do this day if all the pleasures, honors, and riches of the earth might be given me. End quote. Now, I think he was speaking truly. I don't think that he perfectly understood everything. There was no way in his time and place he could have perfectly understood everything. But he was doing the best that he could. Mm-hmm. Other people were not doing the best they could. They would not have been able to say these words truthfully. And that applies as well to the immediately following example of the King James Version, which is 90% plagiarism, or something like that, from Tyndale's work. However, much of the translation of the King James Version, the remaining part, was altered for various reasons. One of the things that was altered was ecclesia. Now, why would someone alter that translation, especially when they knew it to be reliable and they were adopting the vast majority of it for their own translation? What possible reason could there be for taking the translation of ecclesia and changing it?
Political.
Political. Mm-hmm. Or political religious, however you want to describe it. In other words, to fit some previously established system. So that the word of God would not contradict the human system that had been set up. When it actually did contradict that system. Now, again, to show that this was a very conscious effort, my father quotes here from the writings of the King James Version translators. We have on the one side avoided the scrupulosity of the Puritans who leave the old ecclesiastical words and betake them to other, as when they put congregation instead of church. So they don't want to be scrupulous. They want instead to use ecclesiastical words, traditional Christian words. And this forces them, of course, to use traditional Christian words only in settings, only in contexts, when the word can possibly be given a Christian connotation. So, for example, that case of Yeshua speaking to Peter and saying, "On you I will build my apparently church." But it can't be used in Acts when it's talking about the ecclesia of the Ephesians who wanted to kill Shaul. Yes?
Well, I'm hearing you saying in the last few moments, Christian, I think you're meaning Rome, Catholicism purposes. But if I understand you earlier, you're saying that a lot of this, you know, out of context as a pretext, so this agenda started much, much earlier, pre-Constantine for sure. So, am I understanding that correctly? It's much earlier that things start being warped and tweaked.
Well, it is true that things started being warped and tweaked earlier, and we discussed this a little bit in previous classes. For example, it began in the first century, as you can tell from Rav Scholl's letter to the Romans, where he writes to Gentiles that they should not think that they can exist apart from the natural branches, apart from the tree of Israel. Apparently, there were Gentiles thinking that. And that's the same type of thinking that ultimately led to the Council of Nicaea and the dramatic intentional break that Christianity made from what it thought was everything Jewish. Now, as people would discover throughout history, it was very hard to invent a Christianity that had nothing Jewish in it when the only source for Christianity was entirely Jewish. But they did it somehow. So it definitely did begin before then, and certainly in the second and third centuries, Christian theologians developed ideas that were anti-Judaic and ultimately led to the decisions of the Council of Nicaea. But the importance of the Council of Nicaea should not be underestimated, because that's when a definitive decision and proclamation was made, and it was also a proclamation that was supposed to be universal, and it was also declared by Constantine, as we talked about before, that the voice of the bishops is to be regarded as the voice of God, the voice of the bishops in council. In other words, you do not have free conscience. What God says, for you at least, is what we tell you is true. Truth derives not from God, not from your understanding of the scriptures, but from the Council of Bishops.
I think it's, I'm certain that you also identified that there was a hermeneutic break around the third century in the manner in which the scriptures were interpreted, which established essentially the foundation that enabled the Council of Nicaea and King James later on mm-hmm. to make those distinctions and make that break and revise the traditional understanding of the scriptures.
Yeah, we discussed this to some extent. We did not do a study of church history, you know, in the second, third, and fourth centuries. We discussed to some extent
about Origen and
the Vulgate, yeah.
Yes, and the Vulgate, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, these are issues that are very important for understanding what we're talking about. They can be investigated outside this course, too. And this book really does not deal with those issues. There are other books that do deal with those issues. One that my father has written is called The Church and the Jews, and it deals to some extent with that. Other people have also written books on it. And in fact, if you really want to study it, you could actually just get an academic book from a non-Christian perspective, and it will probably explain a lot of this very clearly. Yeah.
I understand the point you're making translations translate church versus congregation. But I was just wondering, because it says on the bottom of 66, Psalm 67, that some languages, they're basically transliterating, like Latin, Spanish, French.
Right.
So how do you make the same point if they're using this is a transliterating word? I mean, I'm sure Spanish means what church means in English rather than congregation, but how do you emphasize that point?
Exactly. You answered the question for me, I think. What does iglesia mean?
Church.
It's, in other words, we talked about the three levels of meaning of words previously. What's the first level? The etymological level, the root meaning of the word. In this case, that's what you're referring to with iglesia, because etymologically it comes from Greek via Latin. Then the second level, the denotative meaning of the word, which in the case of iglesia would be, if we had to translate it into English,
yes,
it would be church. It wouldn't be assembly.
Okay.
If you wanted to say assembly, you would say asamblea or congregacion, right? Or something like that. So iglesia in Spanish means church. And then the connotations would be very similar to the connotations for church in English as well. The connotations being the third level. Yeah.
And then you have the Alice in Wonderland interpretation.
Okay.
Words mean what I say they mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh.
Definitely have that too, yes. I don't know if we want to call that the fourth level, but that's part of the story of how words acquire the second and third level of meaning. Now, just to pick up on a comment from the back once more, though, it's not only an issue of the Catholic Church or even what took place prior to the Council of Nicaea. These concepts carry through afterwards as well. And, I mean, one of the quotes I gave you at the beginning of the class was from Martin Luther. So the very same concepts, or almost the very same concepts, are carried through in Protestantism as well. It influences the entire Christian system, if you will. Now, where were we? I think we were discussing examples of how ecclesia was used. Probably just those two examples are enough.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we can see that when God talks about an ecclesia, he's talking about something that it could be described by kahal, because he's probably not even using Greek words anyways. He might even be saying kahal. And if he talks about his own ecclesia, he's talking about his kahal. Who is God's kahal?
The
Jewish people, Israel. If you don't know that, you haven't read what he wrote. So it's very obvious. And that imbues the entire text with a different significance. Now, was there
a point back to what Peter was saying about when he says, I will build my ecclesia kahal? He was really saying, I will continue to build what has already been established back in at Sinai. But he's, most people read this as that's what Peter was saying, that it seems like he's saying a new thing. So
right.
Even this, I will build, there's something missing there in the translation. He's saying that in a sense, I will continue to build this thing, this kahal.
I couldn't say whether something's missing in that part of the translation or not. We'd have to definitely look at the Greek text. But that's also a question of interpretation that comes after the question of linguistics. So,
would you say that verse is kind of in line with the prophetic language? The prophets would say, and the Lord will blah, blah, blah.
Right.
The Lord will do something new.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's
what you're
saying. It's new. Is that what you're saying? That if you just look at it linguistically, it's comparable to prophetic language?
Well, again, I'm not saying any of this, actually. I'm just saying that when ecclesia appears in the Messianic writings, it means kahal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing that this chapter is saying as well,
mm-hmm.
basically. I might, if I wanted to interpret these passages, I might agree with some of what's being said and disagree with other parts of what's being said and so forth, but it's a different issue. I think the question of prophetic language, of course, is very relevant. And you may know that in ancient Hebrew, in the ancient Hebrew prophets as well, of course, there's no tense, actually. So when you have, in your version of Tanakh, someone saying, I will, or God will, that's an interpretation already that is inserting itself into the translation. Now, obviously, in English, we have to have some sort of tense, but it's not written exactly that way in the Hebrew, actually. So since you bring up Hebrew prophecy, that might be interesting to keep in mind as well. All right. Any other comments or questions? Okay, let's look at page 67. Right at the middle. Maybe church is the wrong word, but it is still the assembly of Christ, or however you want to say it. The body of believers, or what have you. Now, this is a good question, because it's a question we come up against in every chapter. Well, what difference does it make? I mean, isn't it just one word or another word? And again, I think if you've been paying attention up to this point for the first hour of class, then you can see it's not only that. And the evidence of that has not come from me. It's come from you. Because you immediately understand why it's not only a question of words, even if you don't express it to yourself in that way. These reactions that rise up in you are not reactions about, you know, should we call this a dog or a terrier, you know? They are reactions that come from somewhere else, that come actually from understanding some of the possible implications of a purely linguistic change. Now, to drive this point home on page 67, we have a discussion of another possible interpretation. And again, you may think this is far-fetched, but that's only because you're used to thinking in your terms. It's not far-fetched at all. It's exactly what's done in the translations of the scriptures. And it may be even literally done. I don't know. In some Arabic presentations. Who knows? Mm-hmm. And we had previously some quotations about Islam, which drove this point home about the conceptions of the Messiah, if you will, and of Jesus in Islam. So this is not a far-fetched example at all. But the suggestion to consider is that we should translate ecclesia as mosque. Mm-hmm. Why not?